I got into cities. My PhD was in entrepreneurship. I immediately started looking at sustainability and entrepreneurship in 2001, and that was pretty much all I did for several years. And then 2005, I got this itch. I was teaching sustainable entrepreneurship in business schools around the world, and I started feeling like I was missing something because I was talking about how we can change the world through sustainable innovation, but I had never started any companies myself. And this is common in a lot of business schools around the world, people teaching entrepreneurship and they've never been an entrepreneur. And I think there's something missing a lot of times. And in fact, I feel bad for all the students that took my classes the first several years because I didn't know what I was talking about. And I think I know more now because I started about five companies all in the green space and increasingly very urban. I started looking at, I actually had two startups that were, I would call them smart city startups, but way before the term smart cities came around, and I didn't think that's what they were, but they were now in retrospect. Speaking of that, how many people here are current or former LSE students? Not many. The few, the proud, the brave. And then, I wrote the book Climate Capitalism. So I'm from the U.S., and in the U.S., there's this constant annoying dialogue about whether you believe in climate change or not, and it's a political thing. And belief is like, do you believe in God? Do you believe in, life after death? And do you believe in climate change? Like, some things are religious and require belief, and some things are scientific based on scientific evidence, right? But in the U.S., it's actually this polar thing, totally political, whether you believe in it or not. And all the time in the media, you have scientists, and you know the media has an obligation to show two sides of every opinion, right? So they'll put a scientist on TV, and then they'll put some politician who's getting lobbied by oil companies to convince people that climate change is a farce. So my colleague Hunter Lovins and I came up with this idea of writing a book called Climate Capitalism as a way to actually say, you know what? And we actually put this in the Ford. Whether you care about climate change or not, it's irrelevant. Do you want to make money? We can show you a path of making money. And oh, by the way, you can actually help change the world while you're at it. So we try to change the dialogue from do you believe in it or not? Forget it. Who cares about whether you believe in the science or not? What if we show you a path to make as much or more money than you're currently making? Maybe we could shift the dialogue. I don't think we succeeded, but that was the goal with climate capitalism. As I was finishing that book, it was published in 2011. We finished it in 2010. And we were writing in 2009. I don't know how many of you remember, but in 2009, the whole world was like, okay, we are going to save the planet. Obama's coming in to Copenhagen to save the day at the COP. We are going to have a final, a binding commitment to address climate change at a global level, and it failed totally. And I got really depressed, and this was, you know, my whole book was based on the world moving ahead with sort of innovative approaches to climate change. And I said, what are we going to do now? I lost faith in multilateral government approaches to addressing climate change. And I started thinking, well, where else can we look? And I started looking at cities. And the more I looked at cities, the more I realized that was the right place to be looking, more than nation states, and especially more than multilateral. Why? Because cities have been acting around things related to climate change for a long time. And part of that is because the interconnection between climate change and quality of life at a local urban level is very significant. Whereas at a national multilateral level, a lot of governments have a lot of other political conflicts and they don't have as much direct tie-in to the actual negative repercussions that climate change is having at a local level. So I started looking at cities and I thought, well, how do I bring in this idea of innovation, entrepreneurship, and climate change? And I came on this idea of smart cities. It wasn't my idea. People were talking about it for a few years. But I realized everyone was talking different things when they were talking about smart cities. So then as I studied it more and more, I actually was looking at what cities were actually doing, some of the actual plans they were doing, some of the projects they were initiating, how they tied to climate change, how they tied to innovation, entrepreneurship. Long story short, I came up with this model called the Smart Cities Wheel, which you can find online pretty easily. And it's a tool I developed as a framework for understanding and benchmarking cities around the world, how smart they are. So I have six components: smart economy, smart government, smart people, smart living, smart mobility, smart environment. Within that, there's sub-dimensions, and then I have a bunch of indicators. This is all like open source I believe in the commons with this stuff, so it's all publicly available. Not just this, but all the indicators I use are publicly available for use by anybody. The methodology I use to rank and benchmark cities. I'm not doing that work anymore. I stopped about a year and a half ago, the benchmarking and ranking, because it became, when I was doing it, I was the first one doing it, and it felt like the world kind of needed it, but now the world doesn't need it because there's like 18 different organizations doing smart cities rankings, so I let them do it. They have the resources to do it, and the time and the people. So this is one of the foundations of what ends up leading to the book that I'm going to talk about today. This is another foundation. So as I was watching the evolution of the smart cities movement over the last 5 years or so, what I came to realize about a year ago was that we're actually seeing different generations of smart cities. They're not necessarily mutually exclusive, but the very first generation was, I call it Smart Cities 1.0, and it was tech-driven. It was IBM, Cisco, Siemens, saying we've got all this technology we've built for the private sector, why don't we actually find a way to repurpose it and sell it to the municipal space? And this was happening around the time when, of course, the global recession and that companies were not buying a lot of these tech anymore, so they were trying to find new diversified markets for their technology. A lot of cities were trying these at pilot scale because they were wanting to be a pioneer and experiment with new technology without really knowing what the heck they were doing or what the impact would be. Then Smart Cities 2.0 was, okay, you know what? This idea of technology supporting improved efficiency of government and maybe even quality of life, which is really the ultimate goal of cities, right? City administration. Maybe this technology does make sense for us, but you know what? We can't just let the private sector dictate to us what we need and we just say yes or no. We need to get our minds around what a smart city is for us. Where are we going as a city? What are our baselines? What are our strengths already? What are our objectives for the future? And how can technology and other innovative solutions help us achieve those goals? And then once we figure that out, then we can do RFPs, requests for proposals, and find providers to bring stuff in. Most of the cities that are still embracing smart cities today are doing a lot in this. This has kind of died. You won't find a leading city in the world that's thinking this way anymore, just taking tech companies' ideas and just, okay, we'll do what you say without thinking through it very well. But this is the emerging one, Smart Cities 3.0, which I call citizen co-creation. And it's as we've gone from here to here, technology sort of, it's not dropping off the map, but it's becoming more of an understanding that's an enabler. And actually, there are a lot of smart cities initiatives that are really not involving technology, or almost not at all. In my opinion, a lot of mobility solutions in cities still fall within a smart cities framework, even though a lot of them are not necessarily tech heavy. Even things like bike sharing, when I measure how smart a city is, I actually measure how active they have activity in a bike sharing space. Bike sharing does have tech support, right? It is enabled by technology, but it's not. Bike sharing isn't a tech play. It is a mobility play enabled or supported by improved technology. I don't believe they're mutually exclusive. There are cities that are only in one or the other. There are cities that are doing both. And in my dream world, most cities would be doing both. I believe that 2.0 is a requirement because 2.0 means you have political leadership committed to being a smarter city. They actually know what being a smarter city means. They have objectives around being a smarter city. They're going to be open to ideas when they're presented by citizens. And furthermore, I think this is really important, 2.0 actually lays the foundation for 3.0 in a lot of ways. So you think about things like sensor networks, Internet of Things, open data, hackathons. All those things are dependent on the city, Wi-Fi networks. The city, as a leadership, as administration, are actually taking initiative to actually lay out this infrastructure, collaborating, yes, with the private sector to do that, so that then there are even more opportunities for citizens to be creative and add new content and new projects to the city. So this was one contributor to sort of my thinking that led to the book. This was another one. This is an aggregate summary of all of my research over the last 15 years. Which basically, so my PhD is in entrepreneurship and the side field of innovation. I went into sustainability very quickly, and then cities over the last 5 years have been a big focal point. I still do some, I rarely do research that doesn't touch on cities, but it's possible. But I don't always do all three, but I often, this thing is the Smart Cities Wheel in small, and then these are examples of papers I've published or working papers that are at the intersection of all three. Here, these two are obviously key drivers of the book, this innovation entrepreneurship in city space. So here's the book. Pablo Munoz, my best friend, actually. He's from Chile originally. He got his PhD in the UK, and he's back in the UK now. He's a professor at the Sustainable Research Institute at the University of Leeds. He wanted to be here today, but he's actually in Scotland today for our conference. And Richard Florida, some of you probably have heard of. He wrote the foreword to the book. He inspired some of my work, although he and I have diverging opinions on some key things that actually relate to why I believe, and I'm going to share this later, why I believe Europe is actually positioned to be a leader in urban entrepreneurship more than the U.S. is. And my underlying rationale for that deviates from Richard Florida's rationale, so that's where we differentiate on some things. So, like I said, Phil kind of summarized my book so well, I don't know how much I have to do myself, but the foundation is this thing I call the urbanpreneur spiral. And it's my opinion that there are three converging factors that are changing the shape of entrepreneurship and innovation, making them decidedly urban, and actually changing and creating new forms of entrepreneurship we haven't either previously witnessed, we haven't witnessed in mass, or at least we didn't actually document and observe and articulate what's happening around these spaces, and I'm going to share those with you. So the obvious one is urbanization. We all know this. If you're in this room, you already know this. The world's urbanizing. Yeah, okay. 1.3 million people moving to cities every week. We know that. But what we haven't thought enough about, in my opinion, is what are the implications for that for entrepreneurship? And also, going deeper than that, what do entrepreneurs do? They identify problems, right? And they try to solve them, usually with business models. So urbanization is happening for a bunch of reasons, but urbanization is not all good. We witness it here in London, right? You have more congestion, more contamination. You have excess demand on public infrastructure like public transit, housing shortages. Urban food systems are challenged, right? There's a bunch of challenges. We've already talked about climate change. A bunch of challenges that are exacerbated by the growing migration of people into cities. But my opinion is, and it's not just an opinion, I've been researching this, and it's probably not a surprise to any of you, that actually a lot of entrepreneurs living in cities are feeling these pains as citizens, and deciding to become an entrepreneur to solve a problem they're experiencing in their life. Now, normally, we think about people in entrepreneurship. Historically, we've talked about individuals experiencing a pain. So a lot of entrepreneurial opportunities are identified through pain you experience as a customer, as a consumer. And that sort of underlying a lot of entrepreneurship theory and research and observations. That some of the best startups have emerged because you had a pain from trying to do something and you could not get it resolved. You look for a solution, you realize no one is doing it yet, and so, well, I'm going to do it. This happens a lot. So what's different is we have entrepreneurs now that are not consumers so much as citizens of cities experiencing these growing pains and recognizing opportunities to solve those problems. That's maybe been in existence throughout history, but we haven't really talked about them as a class of entrepreneurs. Collaboration. So I have two aspects of collaboration here. We have the collaborative economy or the sharing economy, which is rapidly growing and is definitely decidedly urban. The sharing economy is urban because we have more people in concentrated areas living in cities, and more people in cities are more wired with internet, and a lot of these peer-to-peer, P2P opportunities benefit significantly from having critical mass and density in small areas, and that those people are significantly wired so you can connect to people in real time around needs in real time. So the sharing economy is definitely urban, more than suburban or rural. And if you're interested in just this whole interplay of the sharing economy in cities, there's a fantastic book that came out a few months ago called Sharing Cities by Duncan McLaren and Agyeman. And it's all about this intersection of those two. And democratized. This I'm not the first to talk about how the world is democratizing around innovation and technology, but putting these all together, I think, is something interesting. The thing about democratization, the idea behind it is that in the context of innovation, entrepreneurship, the tools of innovation are democratizing. So there's a quote in my book in the first chapter that is from a guy from Silicon Valley who said in the 1990s, it took about $2.5 million to bring a tech product to market. So you had an idea, you're a group of students or a young startup, you have an idea, you move to Silicon Valley, you want to start a tech company, you're going to build a company, you're going to have to purchase your servers, have a lot of space, it's very costly in Silicon Valley, hire a bunch of programmers to write software, do all this stuff, the marketing costs and everything else, going to cost you $2.5 million just to bring a product to market in the 90s. He said he realized in the 2000s it started dropping around $250,000 because servers went to the cloud. We started getting more open source software and cheaper software. Software as a service models where you don't have to pay to develop all your software yourself. And instead of acquiring licenses to softwares, you can just pay to access it on a monthly basis. So a lot of these things actually drove down the cost of being an entrepreneur. And he said in the 2000s, he would say you could bring a tech product to market for $250,000 instead of $2.5 million. Then he says it occurred to him recently, observing all these evolutions of things, that relate to this whole thing, because not each of these things are not independent. They overlap. And I talk about that in the book. I'll talk about it in a few minutes. But the convergence of all these are actually supporting a drop even further. He says it takes $250 to bring a tech product to market today. Now, I think he's exaggerating maybe a little bit or a lot. Let's multiply that by 10, 2,500, or even by 20 or 50, and you get the point. The cost to innovate is so much less now than it used to be, and I'm going to go into this in detail. We have fab labs, we have co-working spaces, we have Elance and virtual networks to outsource different development that you need. There's so many tools available that you don't need to spend millions to bring a product to market. And I'm going to give you some real examples of very urban kinds of startups that have leveraged that. So I'm going to go through each of these three things with a few examples, like real tangible examples. So urbanizing. This is work from Richard Florida, fascinating work. He's been exploring the migration of venture capital from suburban tech parks into urban areas. He discovered through researching a database that there is more investment from venture capitalists going into startups based in San Francisco than in Silicon Valley. This is just one example, but it's pretty extreme because we always think Silicon Valley is the mecca of the world for startups, and startups aren't even... Actually, there's a lot of tech companies like Twitter that started in Silicon Valley and moved to San Francisco. Why are they moving from suburban Silicon Valley to San Francisco? Because the founders and employees don't want to live and work and commute to Silicon Valley. How many of you have ever been to Silicon Valley? Lovely, urban, walkable experience? No. Car dependent, super expensive, no urban infrastructure, massive behemoth warehouse style buildings. Just to leave your building and go to a building of a friend who's at another company nearby is going to take you 15 minutes to walk there, and you're going to pass like zero restaurants and coffee shops along the way. Now there are a few deviations from that, like near Stanford and Palo Alto is actually a very nice urban area, but most of the Silicon Valley is very suburban, sprawled, super expensive.
And not urban and walkable at all. And not mixed use. You don't have nice restaurants. You don't have artists. You don't have museums. You don't have music. You don't have entertainment. You don't have things that most people today want in a place to live and work. So people are leaving suburban tech parks. And that's why I believe, as Philip mentioned, that I think it's an outdated model to say we want to be the Silicon Valley of X and believe that the solution is to do a greenfield project outside of a city somewhere. Another part of urbanization Phil mentioned briefly as well is this thing about innovation districts. I live in Barcelona now. I've lived in a bunch of cities around the world, and I'm now staying in Barcelona. My wife is making me stay, but I want to anyway. Barcelona is one of the first cities in the world to kind of embrace the idea of an innovation district. An innovation district is a very urban, not suburban, mixed-use, innovation entrepreneurship community. Often, if not almost always, it's part of an urban regeneration project in a historically industrial area of a city that's no longer industrial anymore. And therefore, usually the land is cheap. Not many people want to live and work there, but it's often in a really good location. As you know, a lot of cities, including in Europe, had a lot of industrial activity right on the harbors, right on the interior of the city, and a lot of those areas are still going through a transformation. So one of the solutions is to modernize those areas, but in ways that also promote local economic development and startup activity. So what did Barcelona do? They actually, the first thing they did was implement a high bandwidth data solution to the area, because they knew that tech and startups were moving to areas where they could get good access to good data. There's a lot of tech startups need high speed data and bandwidth. So that was the first thing they did. And of course, because the land is cheaper, because it's formerly industrial, they start renovating the area at cheap prices. Cities often take a lead in, for example, building an incubator space or a co-working space. Sometimes they offer funding for startups. They do things to try to entice larger companies to come. They build co-working spaces, but also co-living spaces. They try to do things to embrace a local community and not displace lower-income people. Vancouver did something really interesting around this in terms of giving a density bonus to developers who are developing in these areas. Say, we'll allow you to build higher if and only if you embed a certain percentage of affordable housing into the same development of an innovation complex like this. So there are things like that are happening. Innovation districts all around the world now. There's a great study that came out, I think it was a year ago, by Bruce Katz from the Brookings Institute about the growth of innovation districts. So you can look that up. It's free PDF online. Now we're moving to collaborative. Cities are increasingly collaborating with startups and the citizen community. Remember the Smart Cities 3.0 space. So this is one of the cooler projects out there where Boston, the mayor, and this guy, Nigel Jacobs, met several times. They created this thing called the New Urban Mechanics, and the idea was to, so we think about how cities and governments in general historically procure things. I don't know, have any of you had any experience trying to sell a product or service to a government agency? Not fun, probably. Okay. So, I used to. So, if you remember, I had a few smart cities companies. One of my companies is called Visible Strategies, and we had a software as a service tool that allowed cities to transparently track, monitor, and report their sustainability performance with citizens. And so, we sold directly to cities, and usually not fun. So, governments normally have a very bureaucratic procurement process, just like all cities and larger governments historically have done that. We're starting to see in the smart city space and in general in innovative city spaces that they're changing the dynamics of how they interact with innovators. So one thing they do now is a thing called procurement for innovation. Barcelona had this thing, it was called BCN Open Challenge. They had six challenges. These were things, anything from how are we going to digitize our libraries to issues around mobility for disabled people. A bunch of, like, six challenges in different areas. And they said, rather than actually predetermine our specifications of our solution and doing a request for a proposal and saying, here's what we want, and you have to go through a six-month process of meeting all the minimum requirements of the city and all the rest of it, they said, we're going to predetermine a budget range for each of these six challenges, and we're not going to say anything about the solution. Because we, as a government, are probably not the most innovative or creative about finding solutions to our problems. We know what our problems are. We know these six problems. We probably have other problems we haven't recognized yet. But we have these six problems we've recognized we want to put budget to. But we're not going to predetermine how to solve them. We're just going to say we have these problems and let the world's innovators, local community people, startups locally and abroad, can pitch their ideas. And they did it blindly, so they wouldn't know if it was Cisco, Siemens, or you and your brother. It was just based on the innovation level of the idea. How well will that solve our problem? So that's procurement for innovation. But that still involves recognizing a problem and then procuring an innovative solution. It's great. But what they've done is gone a step further with the newer mechanics. They say, we don't know all the problems we have in our city. We know some of them. But citizens who live here every day and experience them in their neighborhoods, we maybe not travel to, or we don't ride the bike where they do, we're not going to know everything they know about what our problems are. So what we're going to do is create an office where citizen innovators, I call them civic entrepreneurs in the book, I have a whole chapter on civic entrepreneurs, they explore and identify problems in their own city, and they come up with ideas for solving them. And instead of saying, here's our 20 problems we want citizens to solve, they don't do that. This group, New Urban Mechanics, says, we know we have problems. You tell us what our problems are and what your ideas are to solve them. So then entrepreneurs come to them with some prototypes or ideas about how to solve a problem they've identified. If the city thinks that it's a legitimate problem, that this is not the only person that has it, and that their idea is actually possibly viable and could even be scalable, they'll actually support them in incubating the project, giving them access to urban resources to test their idea. And this is interesting too, if it works, the city has built a network of contacts in other cities, and if they recognize that there are other cities that have the same problem Boston has, they will, but the city, the New Urban Mechanics, will actually help the entrepreneur gain access to these other cities. To me, this is a big trend we're seeing, and Phil mentioned it in the discussion about demand. This is a big trend in innovation in cities, is that we're starting to see cities embrace the idea that maybe the best way to make our city better is to turn it over a little bit more to our innovators, and actually, instead of just focusing on stimulating entrepreneurs who will export whatever they come up with, video games or whatever they want to do, and, you know, we'll create our little video game incubator here. It has nothing to do with impacting our city other than maybe they'll hire people and have some new income that we can get some tax revenue from. They're starting to change the dynamics and say, how can innovators and entrepreneurs actually make our city better? And how can we allocate more of our procurement budget to help them do that? And then how can we turn that into a local economic development story and help them actually export their solutions to other cities that have the same problem? So the world is increasingly a network of cities where cities are starting to diffuse innovation across cities. And there's all kinds of networks doing that. There's ICLEI, there's UCLG, there's a European Covenant of Mayors, there's the Conference of Mayors in the U.S. There's lots of these mayor and city groups around the world that are starting to collaborate and helping to share best practices and solutions that are emerging. So this is another example of collaborative. I don't know how many of you have seen this. This is the AMS Institute in Amsterdam. It's new. It came out about a year and a half ago. Really visionary. Cities putting around 50 million euros to this over a 10-year project. They came up with this idea as a city that what if, so continuing on the same idea, how can the city collaborate with innovators and other people? So I call this a 5P model. You know, we always talk about the 3P people, a public-private partnership. I call this a 5P. People,
Public, private, people, professor, partnerships. Of course, I'm a university professor, so I had to get my name in there somehow. But what it is, AMS Institute, they have at least four major urban sustainability challenges: energy, water, urban food systems, and one other one. They identify those and say, we're going to create this institute in collaboration with local and MIT international universities. We're going to offer master's programs. And what we're going to do is actually get our citizens, via as students, to actually come through programs here and co-develop with our faculty solutions to these four challenges. And the same idea as the New Urban Mechanics in Boston, those solutions that actually emerge and are successful in Amsterdam, they will help them get access to other markets, to other cities in the world. You see the difference? Instead of us just incubating and supporting startups that might do whatever and we don't really care what they do as long as they maybe hire some people, this is how can we actually use our city as a living laboratory, encourage and incubate startups in our community, but not just any kind of startups. Why don't we encourage startups that can solve our own problems? So Singapore did this many years ago. I don't know how many of you know. How many of you have been to Singapore? So beautiful place, kind of unusual, kind of fantasy land in some ways. They have been very dependent on potable water from Malaysia. So up until about 10 years ago, I think 60 or 70% of their potable water was imported from Malaysia. Well, we all know how important water is to sustaining life and human activity. So Singapore are thinking, you know what, this isn't going to work that we have such a high dependence on such a critical essence of life from another country. We got to solve it. So they started encouraging solutions to their potable water problem from local companies and citizens. Now they have over 100 companies generating something like $300 million a year in revenues from projects they do around the world that they first tested and proved in Singapore. So things like recycled water for buildings, for communities, harvesting rainwater. So all these kinds of technologies, they're not the only companies in the world that are doing it, but they've built some expertise based on a demand, a need the city had, and they've turned that into an economic development story. This is too much for me to go into detail on this now, but this is also publicly available. I've published this in Fast Company, and also in there's a website called shareable.net. The colleague who co-wrote the book with me, Pablo and I, we analyzed 36 business models in the sharing economy, and we are trying to understand what dimensions drive business models in the sharing economy, and we ended up coming up with these six dimensions. You see, this kind of looks like the Smart Cities wheel, but it's totally different content. What kind of transaction? Are they more of a market for profit? Do they have alternative, including alternative currencies, or a free model? Are they tech-driven or no tech? Are they peer-to-peer, business-to-crowd, or business-to-business? What kind of governance model do they have? Basically, we discovered that there were this diversity of decisions that entrepreneurs are making in the context of the sharing economy. And basically, what we determined was that the decisions that are closer to the inner circle are closer to what we would call a commons approach to sharing economy. So I don't know, an extreme example of this would be, I don't know if any of you have heard of the Repair Cafe. Repair Cafe started in Amsterdam, I want to say. I think there's like 800 around the world now. And what they are, community activities, self-organized, no money changes hands, and the idea is to repair things that otherwise would have ended up in a landfill. As you probably know, increasingly society is moving away from having a lot of local repair shops to repair everything, and things get sent to landfill because it's cheaper to buy new. Well, people realize that's pretty wasteful, and maybe there's an alternative. So they have these monthly gatherings in cities around the world where people who know how to fix things come together with people who have things that are broken, and nobody pays for anything. And different cafes and other organizations host these events. So that's sort of a really extreme example of a commons approach to sharing. And we all know plenty of extreme examples of what people are calling the, well, my friends at Share will call it the death platform death stars, like Uber and Airbnb, like the Star Wars, you know, Darth Vader kind of evil empires on the outside of the ring. And again, this is a huge relationship to what's happening in cities in the entrepreneurship space, but in general, the sharing economy. And all the cities around the world are struggling with how they're going to regulate and address the sharing economy, the emergence. It's happening so fast, they don't know how to get their hands on it. And so my opinion is they need to start understanding, and I've talked with some cities about this already, that it's not one size fits all. So some cities are trying to say we're either going to be pro-sharing or anti-sharing. And I don't think that's true. That's not the right approach. And it's not even pro-Airbnb or anti-Airbnb is, in my opinion, is the right approach either. Because one of the things that's really interesting about the Airbnb business model, if you unpack it, is that, and I'm staying in an Airbnb here, by the way, a few blocks away. So I'm like trying to save the world and care about cities, and here I am staying in an Airbnb down the street. So if you look at Airbnb in the context of this, for example, you find there's two different models within Airbnb, at least. So to me, one of the most fundamental principles of true sharing is the underutilization or the optimization of underutilized resources, right? So somebody in here has a couch or a bedroom they don't use except when visitors come. Well, if you choose to rent out that couch or bed to somebody, that's an underutilized resource. Is there really a negative impact on this city or society by you doing that? In fact, it's the opposite. Why? Because you actually now can get subsidized, you're subsidizing the cost of your rent, right? And because you're only renting out a room, you're not renting it out to 10 drunk people, which is what happens in Barcelona and Barceloneta a lot. You're renting out to one person. So it's not going to have a major impact on your neighbors or your community. And actually, you're also giving access to tourism to people who maybe couldn't afford it otherwise, right? So a lower income person who can't maybe afford a hotel room in your city, they're a student, but they want to come. You know, maybe cities should embrace those kinds of people. But on the other hand, and we have this in Barcelona, we have this in Paris, we have this in New York City, we have this in Berlin, and this is why there's a problem with Airbnb. Not everybody doing Airbnb rentals is actually optimizing underutilized resource. What we're finding in Barcelona, for example, like in Barceloneta, is that we have investors, entrepreneur investors, that are recognizing demand areas for tourists, and they're starting to acquire local residential property and converting them to upscale Airbnb property. Why is that a problem? Well, we're displacing local residents. Not only that, if you look at the ramifications, the ripple effects of that, what happens is that over time, it happens for the whole building and then the neighborhood. And guess what? The local businesses that were there, the hardware store, a beauty salon. You're there 3 days to get drunk and party. You don't care about a hardware store or beauty salon. So those go out of business. And then what you get in their place is stupid tourist stores that sell dumb things that drunk tourists want for when they're here for 3 days, like fake Barcelona Barca t-shirts and stuff. And it's actually happening on a pretty big scale in Barcelona, and that's why there's this big debate. My point is you got to get under the hood of these business models, because a part of Airbnb's business model actually works for cities, and a part is terrible for cities. So what we should be doing is encouraging the stuff that's good for cities and disincenting or regulating or making illegal the stuff that's bad for cities. And that requires a more rich contextual understanding of the sharing economy. Democratize. So this is the last part of the model. You may have heard about this. Toyota, Tesla is doing the same thing. They both gave away over 5,000 patents. So Toyota developed fuel cell technology for vehicles, and they in the course of developing the technology, they developed 5,000 patents. Well, in the old closed world of innovation, that's our innovation, that's our technology. We don't want anyone knowing what we did, how we did it, and that's why we patented it. That's why we spent multiple millions of dollars patenting these innovations.
Toyota decided to give away for free their patents to their competitors. Tesla did the same thing. Why? Because they realized that if they want to encourage an ecosystem of suppliers, think about electric cars, right? What do you need for electric cars? You need excellent electric batteries, you need charging stations, right? And you need consumers seeing other consumers driving electric vehicles. If you're Tesla and you're a relatively small automobile manufacturer that can't produce that many a year, you can't produce enough to actually change the market. But if you give away your patents, you're encouraging competitors to build new products, but also you're growing demand for things like innovation around batteries. So if Tesla's the only one building electric vehicles, then, you know, if I'm an innovator and a chemistry expert and I have some ideas around how we could radically improve the efficiency of electric vehicles with their batteries, but Tesla's the only potential buyer of my innovation, that's a risky move for me, right? But if actually Tesla and Toyota and Ford and every other manufacturer start building electric vehicles, there's a bigger market for that. Also, because all those people are selling them, there's more consumers driving them. There's also more demand for charging stations. And now Tesla doesn't have to be responsible for rolling out a massive charging station network. So this is an example of how the world is moving towards democratized and open innovation. And it has pretty big implications for cities, in my opinion. So I'm going to give you a couple examples. Have any of you seen this story? It's a famous story. Coolest cooler? All right, I'm going to do this thing. This guy, Ryan Gepper, based in San Diego, he's what we call a maker. I write a lot about makers in the book. Makers are people who like to make stuff with either, like, fabricate them in fab labs or artisans that make things with their hands. And we're finding increasingly in a democratized world that these makers have more access to more tools, more cost effectively, and they have more innovative ways to actually get their innovations out to the world than they used to, and therefore they no longer need that $2.5 million that you used to need to bring a product to market. Ryan Gepper, right here. Idea: let's bring coolers into the 21st century. I should actually have the video embedded in this because it's pretty entertaining because he shows how this thing works. It has a plug for your iPhone. And it charges your phone, but it also has speakers embedded so you can listen to music. You open the lid and an LED light opens so you can see in the dark. It has a blender on top so you can make mixed drinks on it. It has this big giant wheel that actually goes through the sand properly. It's cool. And he calls it the coolest cooler. He felt like it was time to bring the cooler into the 21st century. That's his pitch, right? He makes one of these. One prototype. Trying to make $50,000 in pre-sales on Kickstarter. Remember, he's an urban entrepreneur based in San Diego. He's making one product in a local fab shop, which he doesn't have to buy all the fabrication tools or get access to a manufacturing facility like we used to have, right? So, by the way, there's three fab labs in London, in the London area. I don't know if any of you are familiar with them, but fab labs are actually part of an MIT initiative initially, and they are have to be accessible to the community. They have to have minimum technology like 3D printers, laser cutters, and other resources that makers would need to actually test out making new stuff. Now, those fab labs are not designed to actually help someone like him scale his business and produce thousands of them. They're designed to allow you to test and experiment and make stuff in your community. That's it. And if it works, then you can figure out how to scale. So he wanted to make 50. If he got 50,000 in pledges on Kickstarter, you all know crowdfunding as a platform, as a tool. So Kickstarter is one of the biggest ones in the world. He wanted $50,000 in pre-sales, and he got $13 million in pre-sales. $13 million. This type of person is still not even considered in local economic development circles as somebody they are looking at. They're not paying attention to this thing. Why? Because he's not hiring a bunch of people. He didn't even incorporate a company when he launched this thing. He's making $13 million on an item he's made one of so far. And
The city has no clue he exists or is not doing anything to help him. But urban entrepreneurs are gaining access to all these a growing number of resources that are available to them to innovate like this. And I think we need to be paying more attention to people like him. One more thing on Fab Labs I want to mention. In Barcelona, it emerged this idea of a Fab City. So Fab Labs, there's, I think, 600 Fab Labs in the world. I can't remember exactly. There's now this idea of a Fab City. And it started in Barcelona, but there's a bunch of other cities that are exploring the idea. The idea of a Fab City is that you actually don't just have one or two Fab Labs in different parts. You actually have a Fab Lab in every neighborhood. Again, further democratizing innovation, giving the tools of makers and innovators to the whole community, to the whole city, making it fully accessible, and then thinking through how you could, for example, encourage more local production. We're seeing this already, right? Like, people can have clothes or all kinds of physical goods. They can actually order the 3D file to download. They can pay for a 3D file and download it at a local Fab Lab and produce one for themselves for local consumption. The idea of Fab City is to scale this concept and encourage more and more local production. I don't know if any of you heard about in Amsterdam, there was the one of the world's first multi-story houses was built entirely with a 3D printer with local materials. And then they've produced and operating a bridge now that was made entirely of local materials for 3D printing. So again, rethinking our economies, making them local, encouraging local innovation, using local resources, reducing our environmental impact, and that's where we're headed. This guy, kind of funny story, Plenty of Fish, is a... Probably none of you have heard of it because none of you would ever consider using a dating site. But this is a dating site that he created in around 2005-ish. He'd worked in a bunch of local startups in the tech space in Vancouver, where I used to live. And in his apartment, he decided to play around with some coding and start a little website. And honestly, he had no expectation of becoming rich or anything like that. He was just really testing his skills. And I argue this is example of urban entrepreneurship because he was leveraging the fabric, the entrepreneurial elements of the city in a lot of ways, including the fact that he had worked in a lot of other startups in that dense startup community, and he learned skills that he then wanted to test in the creation of his own. He, while living in a like a 18-story building in downtown Vancouver, he launched this website from his house, started getting some traction, bought his own server for not much money, as you can imagine. And when this article was written, I think in 2007 or 8, I can't remember, it was like 3 years later, he was making $10 million a year. He had two part-time employees that would come to his house, his apartment. I don't have proof of it, but I heard he's making over $25 million a year now and pretty much has about the same amount of staff. It's a free dating site. Again, it's an urban entrepreneur tapping into local resources and expertise and not needing to start a massive company or have a lot of employees or anything. It's another example of how the world is democratizing around innovation. There's the Fab Labs. I've given that story now about Fab Labs, so I don't have to say more about it. That's democratization. This is just the layout of the book, so I go through this, and then I talk about collision density, which Philip already talked about. I talk about different forms of entrepreneurship in cities, which we've already touched on. The civic entrepreneurs who are trying to solve urban problems with business models. We have indie urbanpreneurs, which are like the ones I just talked about, makers. I have three kinds in the book. The makers, like we talked about. The digital ones, like the guy who started the Plenty of Fish website that might do it from their home or from a co-working space. And the third one, which is really controversial, but it's not going away, is this whole gig economy workforce, the on-demand people that are doing everything from... errands for you to in your house to actually the gig economy is going way upstream now. We've got lawyers and doctors in the gig economy that are on demand, virtual, meeting with their patients or clients or whatever they might be, remotely from their home in the city or from a co-working space. And of course, we already talked about the tech migration, so the tech startups that are moving from the suburbs to the to the cities. And then I talk about what cities can do to actually
improve their ability to attract and retain this type of entrepreneur. And this is sort of a really controversial part as I end the book. I was adding everything up and came to the conclusion that I actually think Europe might be positioned to be a leader in the world of urban entrepreneurship. I know it seems a little bit counterintuitive because U.S. is supposed to be the global powerhouse of entrepreneurship. But when you start thinking about these underlying converging factors that are driving urban entrepreneurship, like the spiral we talked about, a lot of those things are way better in Europe than they are in the U.S. First of all, the whole urban thing. I'm from the U.S. I've lived in a bunch of cities in the U.S. U.S. doesn't know urban very well. They're trying to figure it out. But other than a couple cities that are very urban but have other massive problems, there aren't many good examples of really urban cities in the U.S. that are walkable, that are not car dependent, that have a lot of mixed use, that blend lower income and middle and higher income people in similar neighborhoods. They don't do that well. And Europe does. I know. We have plenty of problems in Europe. We have problems with the refugee. We have lots of problems. I know. Brexit, we'll get to in a minute. But I think that we do urban well in Europe is really important because the urban entrepreneur is drawn to the environments that European cities offer. And I have a story I got right before I finished the book was really interesting. I had an interview with an entrepreneur of a company called Urbiotica, and they're based in Barcelona. 2011, the founder goes to Silicon Valley with the idea of moving his company to Silicon Valley. And he starts meeting with investors and entrepreneurs and starts exploring the possibility. And some of the entrepreneurs are like, "Where are you from?" He said, "I'm from Barcelona." "Why would you move to Silicon Valley? We want to move to Barcelona." And it was a shock to him to hear that. But then when he asked why, you know, cost of living, quality of life, you know, weather, lifestyle, you can walk everywhere here in Silicon Valley. We already talked about what Silicon Valley is like. And he also came to the conclusion that venture capital wasn't the right path for him. And increasingly I'm discovering in my research that a lot of entrepreneurs are realizing that. And I don't have time to go into why, but it's kind of related to the rest of the stuff that we're talking about. Smart cities. Europe is way ahead in smart cities. As you know, as I mentioned, I've been studying them for a long time. I honestly think the U.S. is about 10 years behind Europe in the smart city space. I don't have all the reasons for it, although one of my arguments is the density of European cities make them easier to embrace smart city technology. Imagine trying to do Internet of Things in a sensor network and Wi-Fi networks and hotspots in these massively sprawled U.S. cities. It's not easy. Whereas in European cities that are more dense, it's a little easier. That's one of the reasons. I also think because European cities have a higher aggregation of wealth, of educated people, people with middle and higher incomes living in cities already. They have political power and they're encouraging their cities to improve and then there's more demand for it. My research uncovered there's more adoption of this soft infrastructure, like there's more co-working spaces in Europe per capita than in the U.S. There's like three times as many fab labs in Europe than there are in the U.S., even though fab labs came from MIT, which is a U.S. institution. Now, I don't think that's that surprising because, I don't have it in here, but it ties into this. We all know Europe has a tendency to be a little bit more socialist-leaning than the U.S. does. And the commons, the community, is more valued in European cities than it is in the U.S. The U.S. has this, you know, the American dream. I'm from the U.S. The American dream is, you know, you can be as rich as you want to be if you put your mind to it and you put the effort in. And it's a very self-centered culture in general. And Europe has a way more community-oriented culture. I know I'm making generalizations that are not 100% true across the board. We have a lot of problems with anti-immigration issues and all the rest. But generally speaking, and it's not just my observation, there's plenty of research over the last several decades that demonstrate that that's actually a cultural phenomenon. It's not just my observation. Europe has better safety nets. Now, we have a problem in Europe. So better safety nets meaning we have better social services for people that become unemployed than in the U.S. You know, you have better access to health care and education, whether you have any higher income or not, than in the U.S. Yeah, all right, I got to move on. U.S. has lost its lead in innovation already. So there's two really important studies. There's the Global Innovation Index has demonstrated that the U.S. is fourth or fifth in the world right now, and the countries ahead of it are all European. Venture capital is less important than it used to be, and better policy for immigrant entrepreneurs. U.S. used to be good with that, but now they're very anti-immigrant in their policy around entrepreneurs, too. So real quick, is London, where is London on this? I'm just going to skim through this. London is the number one city in terms of the strength of their entrepreneurial ecosystem, based on research not conducted by me. They're number six in the world based on a study that came out in 2015. They look at like six factors of what creates a startup culture in a city. Innovation districts are pretty big in London. There's not just one, there's several that are in different phases. This is a study from the Center for London looking at three aspects of what makes an innovation district, both economic assets, physical assets, and networking assets. These are all the neighborhoods in London that have some components of an innovation district to them, and it kind of this is like a scorecard for how well they're doing. There's a lot of this soft infrastructure. There's a lot of co-working spaces, this artist spaces and maker spaces. There's a map of all of them in London already, so you have a lot of that going for you. But there's this gigantic elephant in the room when you talk about this discussion in London right now. There's two, in my opinion. The obvious one is Brexit, and what does that mean for innovation entrepreneurship in London? And that's an interesting debate that I don't think anyone has a really good answer to yet. Another thing is cost of living. So this is a problem in San Francisco and a lot of cities, right? So if you want to create this high-dense entrepreneurial community that has this collision density between artists and makers, musicians and entrepreneurs and techies and everything else, well, you need to have a community that can that people can afford to live in, so that you have these kinds of interactions amongst all these different stakeholders. And it's increasingly difficult for London to make that possible. And of course, London is not the only city with that problem. But those are the two elephants in the room. London's doing a lot of really good things, but they have at least those two major challenges. And in conclusion, I obviously like circles.
And boy, thank you in particular for making our European souls feel a bit better. Very important these times. Dimitri, over to you.
Thank you, and thank you, Boyd, for a fascinating presentation and a book that really is well worth a read. I was talking to Boyd before. It's my first experience of trying to read something online. This was my first Kindle book, so in some respects, I think I'm sort of quite innovative on the tech scene. In other respects, I'm a real laggard because my mother discovered Kindle many, many years before I did. I like to lampoon her for the difficulty she has in operating a DVD player. Anyway, there are many interesting points that came out. From a personal perspective, actually, I was quite struck by the similarities of the context of in which you built this discussion. You started with your experience in 2008-2009. My background is in climate change. But at that period, I also joined Cisco, one of the tech companies that you mentioned, in leading on the sort of smart cities 1.0 technology frontier at that time. I was equally depressed as you were on the climate change front and the failure to meet a sort of collective action solution at Copenhagen. But I was also getting a little bit sort of antsy about something else you touched upon, because as you rightly pointed out, Cisco was one of the companies that was pushing Smart Cities 1.0. I worked for a sort of in-house sort of boutique think tank that looked at public sector innovation for Cisco, the role of the public sector in trying to drive forward solutions, technology-connected network solutions to public sector problems. Everything from obviously climate, which I was involved in, and sustainability, but also health, education, social exclusion, aging, security, and so on. And tellingly at that point, because we'd just come out of the financial crash and Cisco's share price was suffering, there was a real conflict within the company, which you touched upon, in terms of seeing the public sector as a customer, which is very 1.0 to use your language, so you can just, you know, sell them kit, and seeing the public sector as a much more strategic play, where actually if the public sector is going to work well and provide, you know, civic inclusion and provide the mechanisms for resource efficiency and allow people to talk to people, people to talk to city systems to talk to city systems, and therefore improve both efficiency and governance, there was a massive opportunity for connected technologies. What won out in this case was, I think, short-termism. The group got wound up. You may have heard of Connected Urban Development, which was one of the brainchildren of this group, which I think is still going. It got partly hived out, but Cisco still has an involvement in it. But it's a pity sometimes that the, you know, corporations perhaps struggle, even though they might sort of drive a platform for some of the sort of more civic and organic and bottom-up innovation. They sometimes struggle to see or to find the corporate and strategic vision to try and to stay the course, in a sense, in bringing that about. So it was a very nice introduction, and I kind of personally, I related to it on a personal level. I had a few questions that came out of both the book and the presentation, and I think, counting them here, probably they sum to about four, and I'll keep it short, and I know we're over time, and I want to stimulate ideas for quite, it was very welcome, so it's a good use of time. The problem is we don't have enough time, rather than that you spoke for too long. But, you know, one of the first questions that pops out, and of course you touched on it several times, is the role for policy. What can policy do to promote the successful technology-led, digital, connected urbanization that utilizes both physical capital but also human capital and knowledge networks and ideas, and provides amenity values by making cities more responsive to civic desires? You mentioned a few things, of course, you know, providing a Wi-Fi network, sensors, monitoring and managing system, and setting data free, open data. We've seen that in London, we've seen that in New York. Who here doesn't have City Mapper on their devices? Anyone who doesn't? No, everybody does, right? So, you know, that kind of thing. It wouldn't work if TfL and others didn't provide the data in real time. So it is a classic collaboration between technologies, between urban government and between innovators who built the apps and so on. So it's a classic example. But is there anything else that policymakers can do? Again, you touched a little bit on that at the end. And it links to the second point, which again you talked about, which is density. Do cities have a comparative advantage? Are there some cities, I'll take density as an example because you used it, you know, clearly a dense urban city framework as of the kind that you said. I mean, one of the big differences between Asia, Europe, and the US is precisely the degree of density. There are notable exceptions. San Francisco is one, New York another, where you get the kind of melting pot of ideas, this sort of unique blend of specialization and diversity in a compact form that breeds the kinds of feedback mechanisms that you talked about. But are there other comparative advantages that make some cities innately better placed to take advantage of this kind of urbanpreneurship than others? And to turn that question on its head somewhat, you live in Barcelona, but you also talked about Atlanta. These are the sort of two poster children of kind of different approaches to urbanization and the returns to density. Is the game lost for Atlanta, or is there something that Atlanta can do that takes advantage of its historical, physical, and human, and behavioral, and institutional locked-in frameworks, which is, you know, it's too late now to build bike lanes in Atlanta because the distances just aren't right. But are there other things that Atlanta can do to breed a particular form of urbanpreneurship? And that touched on the Singapore example you gave, where you actually saw challenges as opportunities. You know, there's the sort of famous Edith Piaf quote, you know, use your faults, use your defects. But, you know, Singapore, to some extent, did just that. I mean, it found a challenge and actually became a world leader in building solutions to that challenge. Does that hold out some hope for, you know, Atlanta? And in the, you know, developing country context, which is my third question, you know, does it leave to hope for some very challenged cities in the rapidly urbanizing developing world. Cities that are seen as sort of urban nightmares. You know, we're thinking of Lagos or Jakarta, all the problems they had with pollution, congestion, crime, security, and so on. Might they be right for urbanpreneurs to provide solutions and innovations that can then be relayed across other cities? Because one of the questions that was sort of that I was left sort of wanting to ask was a lot of the examples you gave, perhaps unsurprisingly, because this is about knowledge networks and technologies, were very much developed economy cities, were relevant to the, you know, the richer, more technologically advanced cities in the world. What is the role for those poorer parts of the world, which after all are the parts of the world that are going to see the most rapid urbanization, and for whom to some extent there's opportunity to leapfrog some of the technologies, some of the behaviors, some of the institutions that we've, you know, pretty much locked into in the developed world and now have to either live with or incrementally retrofit and repurpose. And then the final question I had, again, you touched on at the end, but I noticed you didn't sort of specifically refer to it, is housing. To the extent that cities become successful, to the extent that technology innovators move to city centers precisely because of the agglomeration advantages of clustering and density and so on, you have a set of tensions that emerge from that. One is, you know, problems with, you know, associated with urbanization of all kinds, sprawling and death, and maybe particularly dense, which is congestion, pollution, crime, and so on. But another one, if you manage to address those, and in a sense, you know, the first wave of making dense urbanization a success is making sure that the externalities you trigger in the form of pollution and congestion and crime and other access to other amenities, is that even if you solve them, then you get the second wave, which, okay, you've actually got a very viable, successful, attractive urban environment with low crime, lots of cafes, lots of restaurants, you've got cycle lanes and you've minimized pollution. Well, everybody wants to live there, so of course, property prices and rental prices skyrocket. Now, the solution that's given to that, of course, is housing. And what is the role of housing in providing? I mean, it's a topical debate in London, it's a topical debate in San Francisco, it's even a topical debate in Silicon Valley. Do you respond to rising property prices by increasing the supply of housing, which economists would tell you will simply help to alleviate some of the pressures of excess demand and therefore make the city more viable? Of course, that means that more people can come in, you'll get more of the returns to agglomeration, but you might get more of the problems to do with congestion. But there is an insider-outsider problem here, isn't it? The people on the inside who have the houses, who like the high property values, who don't want to have kind of more people coming in, who are a bit sort of nimbyist in their approach, might try and block the very thing that can actually make a city successful and actually undermine a city if you don't build the additional housing supply. So I think those are at least kind of four questions that came out of the discussion. There are plenty more, but in the interests of time and allowing others to contribute and ask far more interesting questions than those, I will leave it at that.
Thank you very much, Dimitri. Now, we started a bit late, and therefore I will go on until 8:15. If you want to leave, please do so quietly, but I think it may be worth to really open this up and be collaborative in the spirit even of the urban entrepreneur in this room. Boy, before answering also some of those questions, I think I want to have at least one round, and then we can maybe incorporate some of this. So, questions, comments, please introduce yourself very briefly, and then try to also give a brief comment so we can bring many voices into this. Anyone, I'm sure at the very end, Adam first, and then the lady over there, and anyone else? Over there, yes, please. So,
I'll actually see my place to the young lady, and I'll have an opportunity, I'm sure, to speak to you later.
Okay, go first.
Hi, my name's Samantha, and I was very interested. My background's in urban sociology, not so much economy. And I was interested in what you said, I'm talking about as someone that solves problems. And that, next to Dimitri's comment on developing countries, I worry about the fact that different people face different
Sorry?
Yeah, I'm curious about patents in the United States being a deterrent to the sharing economy, and how different patent regulations in different countries either encourage or discourage people to share their ideas.
Okay. Good.
Over to you.
All right. I'll try to get through all of them and quick, since I took too long in my presentation. Policy. Yeah, there's so many things. I have a couple of chapters dedicated to that, what big cities and small cities can do, because I have a tendency with my examples, and because I live mostly in large cities in my life, I tend to focus on large city examples and case studies, and I get a lot of questions about what small cities can do too. Policy, I think procurement for innovation is one big one I talked about. I really like, I have a paper I did, we researched different case studies of what cities were doing around different technology to make their city more sustainable. We discovered basically that there's procurement for innovation, there's voluntary standards, and there's regulation that are being used by cities in different ways to encourage the right kind of innovation. So for example, Vancouver was one of the first cities in the world to make a voluntary standard around LEED Green Building certifications, and that actually helped them develop a cluster of green building experts, from architects to product manufacturers to the engineering industry, that actually did it, energy modeling and all the rest of it for the green building sector. So, and Barcelona was one of the first cities in the world to do a solar thermal ordinance. So they required that all buildings over a certain size have at least 30% of their water, hot water, heated from solar thermal. And that actually stimulated a solar thermal industry in Barcelona. So procurement for innovation, voluntary standards, and regulation are three tools that cities have in their policy tool belt. But of course, there's a lot of other things they can do, like the Innovation District, that a bunch of cities around the world are doing, that is city-led kind of initiatives that have big impacts. Some of them are getting more involved. Barcelona is actually actively involved in the development of the Fab Labs in the city. So, and a lot of cities are trying to take more ownership over encouraging the creation of these co-work and Fab Lab spaces in their cities that can entice and enable this kind of urban entrepreneurship. Is it too late for cities like Atlanta? Yeah, Atlanta has a lot of problems, a lot. Very sprawled, massive dependency on autos. They also have a lot of problems with crime. They have a lot of problems with poverty, inequality, different neighborhoods, very poor neighborhoods, wealthy neighborhoods. There's not a lot of integrations. They have a lot of problems. But they've done some cool stuff there, just like all cities have. And I think most cities, you know, the size of London, for example, you're not going to transform London overnight. You're not going to transform London over 10 years. But you can transform a neighborhood over 10 years, like they did for the Olympics, for example, and it could be a pretty meaningful thing. So I think when you get to a certain size of a city, it's not necessarily about transforming the whole city overnight. It's strategic projects in different neighborhoods to transform one neighborhood after another. So Portland is a really interesting city in the U.S., and they really committed to this idea of eco-districts. So they have, I think, last I knew, they had like 6 eco-districts in the city. Each of those districts are little neighborhoods, and those neighborhoods sort of develop their own sort of green angle. So some are really good at local community farming. Some are great at having their own distributed energy system. Some are really passionate about green roofs. And so you don't necessarily have the same thing in every part of the city, which actually is kind of nice, because you kind of get this uniqueness. It's not like the same old everywhere, but you have different approaches to making different neighborhoods green, and you transform these neighborhoods one after another. Turning challenge into opportunities for developing countries and all the rest of it. There's an example that hasn't been achieved yet, but my dream, I lived in Santiago, Chile for a couple of years, which is when I met Philip, and they have a massive problem with air contamination. Massive. In the winter, it's disgustingly massive. And I've always believed, and I started working towards encouraging the government to embrace this idea, well, what if we turn that into an opportunity? So Santiago is not the only city in the world that has air contamination problems. Well, why don't we solve this problem with technology, with innovation, encourage entrepreneurs to come up with innovative technologies and solutions? There's building materials, there's cements, there's more green spaces, there's all kinds of low-tech and high-tech things you can do in a city that can actually help it address this and become a leader. And if they could become a leader and they can export that expertise to other cities, and Santiago is an example of a city in a developing world. So I haven't seen much of it yet in the developing world. What I have seen, though, is interesting. I just came back a few months ago from India, and they've really embraced frugal innovation around India. I don't know how many of you have heard of frugal innovation, but frugal innovation is a sort of approach to innovation that basically, how can we very cost-effectively solve problems in an often low-tech way that are massive problems on a large scale? And they've done all kinds of really cool examples of low-cost innovation you can witness all over the place. So India is a place to turn to look at some examples of the frugal innovation approach anyway. Housing tension, that's obviously a discussion that would last 10 hours, and we wouldn't solve it. But I think there are answers to it. First of all, there's innovation, like Vancouver opened up laneways. So a lot of cities have these laneways in the back of their streets, like in the back of the homes, that are often like little mini, not thoroughfares, but little ways to pass between the community, but not on the main streets. And they open up laneways for homes. So the homeowners can actually build a small little home that's usually enough for two people to live in, kind of like the size of what a garage would be in the U.S. a lot of times, and sometimes they are garages, and they convert them to homes, and now they're legal. So that's an example. I saw the other day in Paris or Amsterdam, some architects have come up with a kit in a box to put homes on top of buildings, like on top of residential buildings on the roof. So you just literally can, with a tower, you can raise the entire house and put it up on a roof of a building, and they're testing it in a couple of buildings. So there's some of these kind of interesting, innovative things to find space where we don't think there is space. I think the other thing I mentioned that Vancouver did really well was a density bonus idea, where for a developer who normally would only have an 8-story building, they're zoned for 8 stories. We'll let you go to 10 stories if you implement X amount of the housing in this development to be affordable housing. And I love that solution, because that's win-win all over the place. It's win-win because you create extra housing in the city, you're creating affordable housing, you're giving a developer access to additional income, which incentivizes them to build affordable housing, and you're putting affordable housing in the same complex where wealthy people are buying houses. You're not putting affordable housing in these buildings 30 minutes outside the city where the people cannot engage and be part of the economy and community. So I think that's possible. Different people with different approaches, solutions, you brought up the idea, different solutions. That's why I would bring back the frugal innovation idea as one way of thinking about it. In the developing country context, looking at more frugal approaches, and it's not one size fits all, and super expensive tech is not always the solution that's required in the city. You know, I think Medellin is a fantastic example. I know you've been there several times. Of a lot of, some are higher tech, like the famous cable cars, but they've done a lot of things that are affordable for their community that are really innovative, and they won the Innovative City of the Year Award in 2012. They're doing a lot of cool things. Is there anything wrong with that? The underutilized resources thing, obviously that's another big question that would take a long time to answer because it's nuanced. But it's not that I would disagree with your point. I would say when you have super capitalist companies involved in the sharing of resources, and we're on the outside of the circle, we have problems, right? So when we can get closer to the inside of the business model compass, I think we have less problems, even when we're optimizing resources. And I'll go to the Airbnb example. Airbnb being a fairly capitalist, kind of not so great company for cities in a lot of ways, they have, on occasion, implemented a temporary permission for residents to open up their Airbnb listings for free to the community after storms or disasters, and then therefore Airbnb takes no transaction fee on that. Now, if you had a company that was actually responsible and would implement that as a policy across the board and say, in the event of emergencies of this level, it's an automatically applied standard, free of charge for anyone in an emergency situation. I mean, Uber got screwed. I don't know if you guys heard this story in Australia. Crazy. Uber they have surge pricing, which is a like ugly capitalist thing they do. And I'm a professor of business school, by the way. But they... they had surge pricing, and there was a bomb in a cafe in Australia, and they implemented surge pricing, which was like 10 times over the average cost for leaving the area. So you have hundreds of people freaked out they're going to die, and Uber is like, okay, well, you know, you don't have to die. We can save your life, but you're going to pay 10 times more than you would normally pay. So we need responsible sharing economy companies that actually will have flexibility in the optimization of those underutilized resources and allow for having a heart and having an understanding of community needs and being responsive to that. Last one, patents and deter to sharing economy. So far there aren't, well, they're sharing of things like Tesla and Toyota sharing patents, and that's not common yet. But then there's the sharing economy. And in the sharing economy, we don't have a massive amount of patents being filed at the moment because most of the sharing economy doesn't have very proprietary technology involved. They are platforms, they're peer-to-peer platforms that facilitate connections and transactions between peers, and there's not really much need for patenting. Now, Uber and some of them have some things that are patentable. But for example, there's this company called ShareTribe. They're out of Finland, and they have it's called a software as a service. They have a software platform that people can rent if you want to start a sharing economy company and you don't have the money to build your own software. And if you're really low scale and you have less than a few hundred users, it's like 30 euros a month. And as you scale more users, you pay more. And it's open source coding. So if at any point you decide, hey, we're growing really big and they're not offering the things I need, you can actually get your code from them for free, and then you just have to hire your own coders to customize it.
Great, thank you. Let's do one final round. This is your opportunity. Anyone else who wants to maybe also comment or provoke?
Yeah, I'll see them up there. I mean, it's a pretty good idea that TPO give the data to CityMapper, but nowadays it's a fact that CityMapper has much more information about the city and about patterns and about citizens than TFIEP, and they don't share the data, so just an opinion or...
Okay, one? Yeah, Harry, please.
Just on this question of the sharing economy, it's kind of, it's one of those phrases that I hear it and alarm bells kind of immediately go off. It sounds like one of those catchphrases that you hear a lot from businesses who want to make a lot of money from you or tech companies who aren't paying their taxes. And it immediately makes you think, well, what does this actually mean? What does it actually imply in practice? I'm wondering if you could maybe speak to the idea that actually, you know, for all of this stuff about open source technology and the potential of a peer-to-peer model, what you're really getting, it may actually not be that new, at least in the sense that if you go and ask a Deliveroo driver in London, for instance, many of whom have been on strike recently for effectively being paid less than minimum wage, they will tell you that this idea of the sharing economy is a bit of a scam. What it really is, as with many economic models in the past, it's based on cheap labor. And that might be what the other dimension is as well. As much as it might be about Wi-Fi density, it may also be about easily accessible, cheap pool of labor. And that might be a more critical perspective on this, obviously, but I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about that and maybe respond to that.
Yeah, interesting question. Real quick on data sharing, some companies, this is a big topic for debate because every company, I mean, so many companies now are monetizing their business through their ownership of data and then what they do with that data, where they sell it to advertisers or to companies or whatever. And so there's a lot of companies like a Facebook that are often kind of closed about what their data and not wanting to share it. I do know, for example, Uber is getting into sharing their data on transport to assist transport agencies in cities to understand more sort of transit issues. So if there's peak demand between two points, maybe they need to improve the public service around transport. So even though Uber is doing a lot of bad things, they sometimes do good things, which is like everything in the world. It's not so black and white. There's a lot of gray in everything. So I think companies should be embracing data sharing more, particularly with municipalities. I think it should be a license to operate. If you're going to do Airbnb or Uber or anything else in the city, you have to agree to be transparent about the data of the city. Now, maybe the city can't freely use it for anything they want, including reselling it or giving it to a competitor, but for planning purposes, they better be able to use it. And a similar thing that goes back to the sharing economy is exploitation, and it's a good transition to answering that next question. I had a meeting with the mayor of Paris's right-hand person on the economy, forget her name, it was a couple months ago, about Airbnb in Paris, and this was fascinating to me. France has a law on the books that any rental unit cannot be rented for short-term tourist rentals for more than 120 days in a year, and Paris knows that that's being exploited by Airbnb owners in Paris, and they went to Airbnb and said, can you help us enforce our regulation? And Airbnb, to this day, at least last I knew, has refused to allow that. And it goes to your question about data, because, and to the question about what sharing economy companies are doing around exploitation, in the sense that, you know how easy it would be for Airbnb to actually control and regulate that? It would be so easy. I'm talking 2 minutes of code. They could actually have an automated system that would notify owners when they're approximating their maximum amount of days they're allowed to rent on the platform, and they would cut them off immediately when they hit their 120 days. It would be that easy. But they don't want to do it because it cuts into their profit. So we have major problems with these, and this goes to this point of exploitation around the sharing economy. My argument is we cannot paint the sharing economy with one brush, which is why I did this thing around studying 36 business models and the six dimensions that underline them. So not all sharing economy companies are Airbnb and Uber and exploitative. Many, like I gave a major extreme on the other end, like the repair cafe, there's no money changing hands and there's no ownership of anything, and it's a community resource, so it's for the commons. So, and there's a lot of stuff that's in between, a lot. I mean, bike sharing is part of the sharing economy. Now, depending on how it's rolled out in London versus Barcelona, where there are different corporate interests involved in bike sharing, but as a general rule, that's a service that's not so exploitative and generally has a positive benefit for society. So my point is there's a lot of different things. There are a lot of sharing economy companies that are very exploitative, and I don't consider them part of the sharing economy. To be honest, I think they're really more in the gig economy, which is a sort of a similar thing, but they're really about exploiting low-cost work. And I don't know if they're going to be around forever, to be honest, because I think there's going to be increasingly more and more regulation. And this is the fascinating thing. This is like the next step. I'm reading this book called, you guys probably know it because he's a pretty well-known British author, Paul Mason's Post-Capitalism. To me, that's part of the next wave, including where the sharing economy is going. So there's this thing, I don't want to go into detail because we're out of time. But there's a thing called a distributed autonomous organizations, DAOs, that use this other thing called blockchains sometimes as a way to facilitate peer-to-peer transactions without intermediary monetizing the transaction. They're early stage, there's lots of problems with them. Mason talks about them, so does the guy who wrote the book on throwing rocks at the Google bus, I forget what that was called, Rushkoff. But I think we're going that direction. I think we're going to go to direction, and there are, for example, taxi operators now that are coming together as a cooperative or collective and saying, you know what, screw Uber. We're going to build our own mobile platform to allow private citizens to find us taxi drivers and have the same kind of quality service they get from Uber, but there's not going to be any intermediary that's monetizing that connection between us. And we're close to being, I mean, there are some, actually there's one in Denver already that's operating that way, so that's not a DAO because it's a co-op. It is sort of technical, but it's a cooperative of taxis that are sharing in the revenues directly, and there's no intermediary. I think we're going to go there.
I'm afraid we need to bring this to a close. Very elegant at the end of the book launch to have another book in the air. Thank you for that. Let's thank both Boyd, of course, and Dimitri, and most importantly, the audience for also